Come back and we can get started. At the beginning, I was thinking I would rather stand right down here and talk. I wish I had done that. Now, I think there's something more interpersonal about that. I can hardly see you with these lights in my eyes, and I'm feeling there's that lack of interpersonal kind of dimension in my communication, but and I feel like I'm just pouring a bunch of information out, and I suppose that's exactly what I'm doing as a result of this. So I want to move on and continue. I have one more thing to talk about in talking about that first aspect of pastoral ministry and nurturing, and that is pastoral care. One of the things that I was never good at was pastoral care, and that's one of the reasons I got out of the pastoral ministry. But the pastor I was working with in that church renewal had a deep sense, again, of the importance of structures and a lot of the internal life of the church for mission. And very often, you know, we talk a lot about how pastoral care is often in the grip of a very introverted and very consumeristic orientation. That is, it's turned in on itself, and it's only trying to gather people in and provide that pastoral care to keep customers coming to church. And so the church is seen as a vendor of religious goods and services that's serving the customer. And one of those things we can provide is good pastoral care. Where it seems that pastoral care in the grip of a missional vision is going to be very different. It's constantly going to nurture towards health for the sake of the world. In other words, reminding that people are they're growing in the gospel, becoming healthy, not simply so that they are psychologically together and feeling good, but so that they are being nurtured for the sake of the world. And again, I'd love to stop and give a lot of stories about that, but I won't. Now we move to that second aspect of pastoral ministry, witness of church in the world and various themes. Here's the kinds of things I'm talking about in this second thing. Understanding our cultural context. Being a distinctive community. Training folk for their callings in the world. Evangelism. Involvement in the neighborhood. And what I call missions, cross-cultural missions, taking the good news to places where it's never been heard. If we are called to be a distinctive people, if we are being absorbed into the idols of our culture, we are doing exactly what Israel did in the book of Judges as it was drawn into the idolatry of the Canaanite nations. And T.S. Eliot, already in 1946, makes this startling comment. In 46, he says, "The problem of leading a Christian life in a non-Christian society is now very present to us. It's not merely the problem of being a minority in a society of individuals holding an alien belief. The problem is not just that we're in a minority. It's the problem constituted by our implication in a network of institutions, educational, political, social, economic. Our implication in a network of institutions from which we cannot dissociate ourselves. I have to speak the English language, participate in the economic system that governs North Canada, and so on. Institutions," he says, "the operation of which appear no longer neutral, but non-Christian." I wonder if we really believe that about our economic system, our social systems, our political system, our educational system. And as for the Christian who is not conscious of this dilemma, and then he makes the powerful statement, and he is in the majority in 1946. He is becoming more and more de-Christianized by all sorts of unconscious pressures. And then he talks about one area, paganism now holding all the valuable advertising space. There's a book that's been written in the last 10 years or so by a colleague I used to have at Regent. And he shows how the various institutions of Western culture are conforming more and more the people of God into the humanist worldview, and most Christians in the West, United States and Canada, are unaware of it. And so we need to help our people begin to step back and analyze the current religious beliefs that are shaping our world. And the way these religious beliefs are shaping the institutions and structures and customs and life of culture. And that might seem like a daunting task for the pastor, but I think there are ways to do it, at least in ways that we've tried to do it, in preaching. When we're constantly, as I mentioned earlier, encountering the stories of our culture. In teaching sessions, usually we do these on Sunday night, in teaching sessions where we address these kinds of issues. In small study groups, taking our people, moving them in that direction to study these things. And my own son-in-law working in youth ministry has found this one of the most valuable things he can do in youth ministry is helping those guys and gals learn to analyze their culture. And he got some resistance at the beginning, but that youth group has doubled in size as they've taken seriously that task of what it means to understand culture and live in it. A second thing is training the laity. And let me make some sort of, challenging statements about this. Number one, I think the laity and our everyday 6-day-a-week lifestyles plays the central role in the witness of the church to the truth of the gospel. That is the primary place that witness takes place. I believe, secondly, the congregations have to find effective ways to train and equip the laity for their callings. I think thirdly, generally speaking, this kind of training and equipping, even though there's been a lot of talk about it since the 1960s, has not really taken place. And fourth, I believe that most Christians, as they leave their place of worship on Sunday, are godly, well-meaning believers who are often more shaped by the Western story in their work than they are by the biblical story. And so that looking for ways that the local congregation, and you're going to need unity here, can train people for their callings is desperately needed, I believe. I think a congregation is called to do at least three things: nourish the new life in Christ of those people, to support people in their local callings. Different stories I'd love to tell here, but of a missional community where a woman comes in and says, if I'm to keep my job, I've got to live in this way that'll disobey Christ, and I've got one person to take care of, I'm a single mom. And the missional community went around and said, if we're going to ask her to obey here, we've got to pick up and take care of her financially. Are we going to ask her to obey and do that or not? And they went around, each person had to say yes, they would participate in caring for her if she got fired by obeying. It's that sense of supporting folk in their callings in ways that the early church did in Jerusalem, as well as looking for ways to equip folk in their callings. I think these kinds of things are pretty urgent issues. Contextual evangelism. I heard Jonathan give a great talk in Chicago on this, and so maybe I should just let him do this, talk about this. But evangelism must be contextual in that it's both challenging and relevant. Speaking to people where they're at, but challenging them to come out and repent from where they're at. Kramer, who said some of the best stuff on this, has said there is an obligation to strive for presentation of the Christian truth in terms and modes of expression that make the challenge intelligible. And that's the heart. Make the challenge intelligible and related to the peculiar quality of reality in which they live. And so this can only be done by somehow challenging and encouraging our people to spend time and get to know other believers. And talking about what it means to relate to them in humility and love and so on. And learning a dialogical approach rather than dogmatic, refusing to offer cheap answers and so on. In other words, struggling with this and helping our people understand what are ways in which a postmodern community can hear the gospel. Incidentally, I'm going to be skipping things. You'll get all these slides. in the end, you can do what you want with them. Press delete, or if you want to use them and read them. But the thing that strikes me most about evangelism that has to be taught today, and I'm not going to read this quote, I'll let you read it later, is that it needs to be organically connected to life. That instead of being some kind of car salesmanship where we learn a method and learn like a sheepdog to move people towards faith, we have to learn to organically connect our announcement of the good news to people's lives where we're living at them, living with them. And I think, for example, of an evangelistic conversation I had with a man over an 8 or 9 hour trip to London, England. And he was complaining about the educational system. And I said, yeah, I agree. Bad news, isn't it? And then work through that to show how its service of idolatry was leading to the problems we're seeing in education. And then he finally says, where are you getting this kind of thinking? I said, well, I'm a Christian. I think Christ needs to be Lord and solve these problems. He says, oh, yeah? Tell me how. And in other words, connecting to where his felt need was in terms of education and where his daughter was at. We need to have it organically connected to the reality of our lives and others' lives. The next thing, what does it mean to be involved in our neighborhood? And I could look at this simply by Miller's book in Outgrowing the Ingrown Church. He tells the story of a certain Dutch church, which will remain, the denomination will remain unnamed. And that Dutch church had no relationship with its community. Then he said all of a sudden a tornado blew into town, blew the roof off a widow's house. And the deacons got up, went down, and replaced her roof for free. And he said it entirely changed everything in that church. Everything. And he says, the problem we often have is what he then illustrates, that illustrates a number of things. The problem we often have, he says, is opportunity blindness. It's not that there aren't any opportunities, we're blind to them. Our church, one of the things that led to the renewal of that church I was a part of, was when our outreach pastor came in and he said, you know what? Within 3 steps of the front doors of this church, there are people who are mentally challenged and immigrants who have all kinds of needs. We immediately focused ministry there, and all of a sudden, things happened. We're often blinded, and we don't see these opportunities. But what happens when we begin to really contribute to the community is that there's a changing attitude of the church and the neighborhood, says Miller. And he says, this is important to do this. There's got to be pace-setting deacons. That is, deacons who understand the importance of this and basically say, follow me as I show compassion and justice in my community. And it illustrates the power of compassion. If you want to read a great chapter on this, Adolf Harnack's book, The Church in the First 300 Years, has a chapter called The Gospel of Charity, illustrating the way the early church so powerfully made known the good news in its life. And commenting on one of the aspects of that, Pope Benedict says this. In one of his letters, Julian the Apostate, he was a Roman emperor 2 after Constantine. His name is Julian the Apostate, and his mother didn't give him that last name. He was given that name because he was trying to turn the Roman Empire away from the gospel, back to paganism. He says, in one of his letters, Julian the Apostate wrote that the sole aspect of Christianity which had impressed him was the church's charitable activity. He thus considered it essential for his new pagan religion that he was trying to establish that alongside the system of the church's charity, an equivalent activity of its own be established. And according to him, this was the reason for the popularity of the impious Galileans. They now needed to be imitated and outdone. That's a true commentary on what Julian the Apostate did. First thing he did in his pagan religion was appointed deacons. First thing he did, he appointed deacons and said, okay, take care of the poor. We got to beat them at their own game. We're trying to kill them. It's not working. So let's outdo them at their own game. And then the last thing I want to talk about here is in terms of mission and missions. Mission is the total task of the church to make known the good news in all of life. Missions is one part of that. that establishes a witness where there is none or where it's weak. And the missional church has lost sight of this. We're not talking here about intercultural interchurch aid. We're not saying if I went to Kenya in the south to be a seminary professor, that's not missions, just because I went over the seas, because I'm helping a church. And that's important and good. But if I went to the north of Kenya, where there are very few churches and all kinds of unreached people, then I'm doing missions, because I'm establishing a church in places where there is none. And this is terribly important for the whole mission of the church. And I can point you to reading in this if you're interested, because this is the horizon of the church's mission. And only when its vision is to the ends of the earth will it see mission, its own backyard. And many people have been pointing out what Bryant Meyer calls the scandalous disproportionate allocation of missionary resources, by which he means people give to missions and 95% of personnel and money goes to interchurch aid, and the places where there is no churches get 5% of the money and the personnel of North American missions. And he says that's a scandal. That 1% of our, less for him, according to him, of our financial resources and about 10% of our personnel resources are devoted to cross-cultural work that actually served the purpose of establishing a witnessing present to the gospel in unevangelized areas. Take a look at the missionaries you're supporting, which I hope you are, and ask, what are they doing? We've moved to the third area of structures in the church's calling. And this becomes a lot more tricky, because the problem in the United States, I think, often is somebody has a new structural way of doing church, and it thrives and grows, and then everybody else tries to copy it. And when they do so, it doesn't work in their context. And so talking about structures is a very difficult thing. And sometimes I think we need to step back and just say, we're not going to tell you what structures to have, but here's what you need to think about. I think we need to start by saying structures can either enable or hinder the church from being faithful to its calling. And as we look at the 20th century ecumenical history, this is something we could overview in a long period of time, but let me do it in 2 minutes. We see that in the period of 1938 to 1952, there was this development of a missional understanding of the church. The next step, they believed, was to deal with the structures that were hindering the church from being faithful to its missional calling. And so that was the next task in the 1960s, to try to get new structures. And so they wanted to facilitate this missional identity. The problem was, it got blown off course by the secular winds of the 60s and the 70s, and it never really happened. And so it's interesting that the book in 1999 called Missional Church that stirred all this up, they were returning to the 1952 history and saying, what does this look like in North America? Sadly, most people are not aware of that rich theological history, and so they think that 99 was the beginning of Missional Church. But it was returning to an older story. And what it was asking was, what would it look like to be a missional church in the West? And they were concerned by continuing that story to move to ask the question, what kind of structures would facilitate the church in its mission? And I think that when we start to think in that way, we need to ask, what can be done? Now, let me just give a few quotes from Newbegin on this. He says that every discussion of the structures of the church presuppose an ecclesiology. Hidden or acknowledged. This is about the strongest statement you're going to find. And if it didn't come from Newbegin, I'd probably dismiss it as heretical. The structure of the church is itself an expression of the gospel. The people of God are living to embody that good news, and the very way they do it, structurally together, will express the gospel in some way. He says, we're now saying that we've recovered a radically missionary theology of the church, but the actual structure of our churches does not reflect that theology. On the contrary, it continues to placidly reflect the static Christendom theology of the 18th century. And therefore, he says, the highest priority must be given to bringing about those changes in the structure of the church. Now, this is where it would be nice to talk about each one of these things in a lot of detail, but just to throw these things out for your consideration to think about. The importance of small groups. Boy, we need a lot more theological reflection on how they can go bad and how they can function in the mission of the church. Moreover, we need a lot more reflection on the kinds of small groups there are and what they can accomplish ecumenically and within the local congregation. This is an unfinished discussion, even with thousands of books out there, because there's the lack of a theological reflection on a lot of this stuff. The missional community model, the same thing, I think, as it's now making its... You know, as I travel in different places and hear about missional communities, there's different understandings of these things and how they function. And again, there needs to be the deep theological reflection on how can these really be missional communities while at the same time nurturing the people for the mission of God. Another thing that I think is the need is leadership structures and training. You know, as I look back at how I used to train leaders, I realized what a bad job I was doing. And asking the questions, how our leadership training, whether or not the very way we structure that leadership training is contributing to the mission of the church, and the way we are structuring our leadership. I just think of Acts 6 and the flexibility of the church in Acts 6 when all of a sudden the church was not manifesting the good news in Jerusalem because of this jealousy that became between the Hellenistic and the Jewish widows. And immediately they look for a new leadership structure that will resolve that. And they say, look, we got to keep preaching the gospel. We got to keep praying because that's the source of the life of the church. But let's point leaders to take this. And I think what we got to be asking is those kind of flexible, contextual questions. What is needed in leadership in our churches? And be much more creative in seeing how that leadership can help us. This is huge. Ecumenical structures. If a lot of this stuff is sinking in and has sunk in long before you came here, then you realize, and it was said on the video before, there's a lot of things we can't do by ourselves in local congregations, no matter how big we are, and how we desperately need ecumenical structures. And I've seen one working. Our church began in Hamilton, Ontario, and they called it True City, and they began connecting the churches in mission. And what grew out of that was quite remarkable. Look up truecity.ca to see what came of that. And I'm working with groups in Phoenix, the same kind of ecumenical. They're doing things that they could never do by themselves and asking, how can our ecumenical structures help us carry out the mission of God in various places? How can we get beyond the jealousies and the protected terrain of our own kingdoms? I approach this with fear and trembling. And so I'm just going to say something quick and then I'm going to cowardly run. Budgetary issues. The question that we need to ask is, how are we spending our money? Wilbert Schenck, Mennonite missiologist, was at Fuller, makes the comment that you can tell what the priority of a church is by how they spend their money. We've got a record from 231 from the church in Rome. And if I remember right, now I'm trying to draw the figures back into my head, but I think it's something like 80% of the church's budget was taking care of poor people. 20% was taking care of the leadership of the church. And the interesting thing about that is most of them were, believe it or not, exorcists who cast out demons. They were the ones that were primarily being funded by the church. But aside from that, we need to ask the amount of money spent on salaries and buildings. I'm not sure ways around this. I really am not. We're struggling with this in our own church, and boy, we're spending a huge amount on our church at this. So, but budgetary issues are important to think about. Well, I was going to talk about the importance of next baby steps, but I'm going to let that go. And I'm going to move to the last thing that I was going to try. It's only a few slides, and I've got about 10 minutes. Is that right? Where's Todd? Okay. I'm going to assume I have about 10, 12 minutes. I wanted to tell a lot of stories with these. This is a list that's been an ongoing list. If you've read Gospel in Plural Society by Leslie Newbegin, you know that he talks about the church as a hermeneutic of the gospel. That is a church that interprets the gospel to the world, and he has six things. Now, doing my dissertation, I realized that that was being quoted more often than any other thing Newbegin said, but most people didn't know he did that several other times with different lists. And what he was always doing is saying, what are the idols in our culture, and what does it mean for the church to live over against those idols? Or what are the life-giving things in our culture that are good, and what does it mean for the church to seize them? Let me give an example. If consumerism is a death-dealing idol, then what does it mean to live against it? If a new concern for, say, ecological and economic justice that permeates our culture is a good thing, what does it mean for the church to seize it and live that out in light of the gospel? That's what Newbegin was always doing when he presented these lists. Now, my list started with about six things. It's now grown, especially through a number of sermon series, to about 18 or 20. I don't even know how many things. And I want to suggest, I'm going to tell you at the end, how these may be able to be used as a pastor. What does it mean for the church to embody good news in the midst of 21st century North America? Friedrich Nietzsche, if you know him, the nihilist philosopher, says, "They would have to sing better songs for me to learn to have faith in their Redeemer. And his disciples would have to be look more redeemed." Now, it's a very interesting context in which he writes that. He's talking about joy, the joy in life, and especially in sexuality. And he's saying the church doesn't know how to rejoice and live joyfully in enjoying God's, well, we'd say God's creation. And he's saying the church better learn how to live joyfully if I'm going to believe their gospel. Well, what would a redeemed community look like? Not in Colossae by reading Colossians 3, but in North America. What does this mean contextually? Well, let me put out a number of things. And again, because I can't tell stories in light of time, you can at your tables. In your 10 minutes if you want. It would be a community of self-control and marital fidelity in a world that is saturated by sex. That was a powerful, powerful thing in the early church. The early church was known for their self-control and marital fidelity, and there are instances of people who've come to Christ as they notice that. A community of truth, but truth that is held with a kind humility, but also a gentle boldness. In a world that is uncertain about truth and very suspicious, it'd be a community that knows God's presence. Remember that sermon I talked about? That knows God's presence in a secular world that has removed God to heaven and has created this closed nexus of cause and effect relationships by the scientific worldview. A community that defies that and lives in the presence of the living God at all moments, the way we were meant to live in the beginning, is going to say very loudly, this is what's coming on the new earth, the knowledge and presence of God that will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. It will be a community of generosity and enough in a world of consumption gone mad. I wish we could study the early roots of a consumer society, and they make you mad. I remember one time speaking about the early roots of a consumer society in a lecture to some seniors in university. And a young lady puts up her hand and she says, "You mean the way I'm living now is because of some choices made in North America in the first 50 years of the 20th century?" I said, "Yep, that's exactly what I'm saying." And she goes, "Oh," I can't say what she said. But she then used a bad language and really and swore and says, why haven't I heard about this kind of the way consumer society has developed? And I think often we're not aware of our own story, our own history. It's out there. We can learn it. But we're not aware of it. And we don't realize that up until the beginning of the 20th century, one pair of shoes was normally enough for people. And they had to be trained to think that they needed two and three. Okay, I won't say any more. The point is that generosity and living enough, what one rabbi calls, what does he call it now? He calls a consumer, a sanctified consumerism. That as Christians, we learn to enjoy and delight in God's world, but learn how to do it with a sense of justice and a sense of enough and a sense of generosity. A community of forgiveness in a world of hatred, competition, violence, grudges, and revenge. And if you don't think that is true, look at the games that are coming out, video games that are coming out, look at movies, and look at the way people use language when they're commenting on the news on the internet. A community of praise, and I might say encouragement, praise to God, encouragement to others, in a world of narcissism that is turned in on the self. This by itself would transform, I think, most cities in North America. A community of self-giving love in a world of selfishness, egocentrism, self-gratification. A community of wisdom in a world of proliferating knowledge and information technology. I think this is even true in the academic world. So many scholars you can work alongside of that have so much knowledge and so little wisdom. And so many of us are bursting with growing knowledge from information technology, but no way of synthesizing that, or as one poet says, weaving all our knowledge into a loom. In other words, wisdom that weaves knowledge into a loom and a whole worldview rooted in the gospel. Community of wisdom. A community of humility in a world of arrogant self-interest. I'd like to talk about that in my own field. How arrogance and self-promotion dominates the publication of books, websites, people promoting themselves for speaking, and what that's doing for a church that's talking about mission. We need more humility in a world of arrogant self-interest. A community of patience in a world of immediate gratification. Are you like me? Something doesn't work that quickly. You're angry and impatient already. Well, there's so many illustrations I could give of this, but I sometimes think when I stand up to preach that this community out there that is so nurtured on immediate gratification is going like this. You got 5 minutes to make this relevant to my life. And if you can't make it relevant to my life in 5 minutes, I'm out of here mentally. And the tremendous pressure that you feel when a sermon, as one author has put it, is trying to travel from Abraham to the 21st century in a half hour. But immediate gratification dominates our church life in all kinds of ways. A community of compassion in a world numbed by overexposure to violence and to tragedy on the media. I mean, sometimes you almost get the sense of CNN yesterday was broadcasting this new tragedy that just took place in Washington, that they're almost glad that they had some good news to share with people. And we've become so numbed, it's become one more form of entertainment. A community that uses language positively. Listen to what James says about language. It says that tells you what's in the heart. A community that uses language positively in a world of destructive communication everywhere. A community of depth in a culture of superficiality. I'm going to share with you in a minute what you can do with some of these things, but I remember one time starting with this great article on superficiality, spending 10 minutes opening up what this psychologist said about how superficiality dominates our culture, looking at different ways, and then going to the gospel and speaking of what it means to be a community of depth, where people say, there's somebody with depth. A community of cheerful seriousness in a culture of triviality, where we trivialize life. I mean, I remember standing next to a young lady watching her, I shouldn't have been doing this maybe, but watching her text and what she was saying. I was standing on the bus and I couldn't help it. Well, I could, I suppose. But as she was texting, she was saying such important things like, what are you doing? Yeah, me too. Like really important things. And how this is so often trivialized, how technology has trivialized our lives. What does it mean to be serious about life, but for there to be a joyful, cheerful seriousness? A community committed to the important issues of our globe in a world of apathy and indifference, where we become apathetic towards the needs of others and indifferent towards them. A community of self-giving in a culture of self-absorption, narcissism, and especially in a world of entitlement. Boy, that next generation, dealing with that, there's a couple of really good books out there on narcissism, entitlement. If you haven't read them, there's probably a lot more than that, but ones that I've come in contact with, and I just saw that at university education, how more and more dominated by our sense of entitlement. And then I say, is it just the younger generation? Or do I have this deep sense of entitlement when I don't get good service in a hotel or a restaurant? Do I have that deep sense of entitlement that the airlines and everybody else needs to treat me like I deserve? That sense of living out a self-giving in that kind of culture. A community of joyful purpose in a culture that is amusing itself to death, to use the title of a book. A community of joy in a world dominated by a frantic and hedonistic pursuit of pleasure. And finally, a community of thankfulness, gratitude in a world of entitlement. I think that's one of Paul's main things in his letters, is to talk about gratitude. There's an article been written by a Pauline scholar, and he talks about... I've just forgotten the title. But basically his argument is thankfulness and gratitude is the primary spiritual quality that Paul speaks about of a Christian. And the difference between the unbeliever and the believer is between gratitude and ingratitude. Well, that's a quick list. But how can we use this list? Well, this list, I'll conclude with this. Here are some things. This is constantly in my background. I'm constantly working with this list, changing it, adding to it, changing it around. First of all, it's so helpful as a background goal for ministry. What are we trying to do in our churches? What are we trying to nurture? Who do we want to become? Because if we aim at that, that's what we'll probably become. What vision do we have that is guiding our goals and our structures and our ministries and our thinking through what we're aiming at? And the more we have this deeply embedded in our consciousness, the more it's going to help us say, well, how can we reach that goal to more and more see a community like that shaped by the gospel? It can come as explicit challenges to the congregation. You would not believe how many of these have come out of sermons where you saw, say, the book of Colossians addressing live this way in light of the Roman Empire, and how many these things naturally came out to those living in the 21st century and enabled us to open up ethical life for the believing community in the context of their culture. And that's why I think it can especially guide our preaching and our teaching. It can guide all kinds of ways, if you want to use a language, I don't like it, but of application of the text in knowing what the gospel is calling us to be and to become in the midst of the world. And so this list can become something more than just a nice list, but something that can really guide us as a missional church in our preaching, teaching, our structures, and a lot more. And finally, I think leadership is about what Paul said, follow me as I follow Christ. And that means this can help begin to shape us as we reflect on these things so that our own life becomes a model. And we can say, follow me as I follow Christ. And I'd like to stop and tell some stories, but I'll just finish with one of our pastor in Hamilton who basically took in somebody that was very, very dangerous into his home. A person that was exceedingly dangerous in the community. And people were saying, are you crazy? He can take the life of your own family and kids. What are you doing having him down in your basement? The guy became a believer, was baptized, and it was a very, it was a powerful, powerful thing. But he was kept saying, if I'm going to talk missional, I better be living it. Follow me as I invite the marginalized into my home. Follow me as I follow Christ. And I think that list can help us think through what that would look like. Okay, I think what we're going to do now is have some time of reflection to think. I think, am I right? We're going to reflect on some questions, or is it going to be question and answer? I better just shut up. I'll finish there, and I'll let somebody else take it from here and decide what we're going to do.